I should have said the poet. I should have said the poet. The poet.
Sending poets. This is Sending Poets, a podcast about ideas. Our goal is to understand metaphorical truths within the beauty we find in the human experience. My name is John. With me is Bob. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, good morning.
And Tucker. Good morning, Tucker.
How you guys doing?
And for this episode, we're going to try a traditional three-person debate on specific factors between subconsciousness and consciousness. So pretty excited about trying this out, see how it goes. If you listen to previous episodes, you know, this three-person debate, the idea is that one person is the defender of the faith, one person is the heretic, kind of saying, I'm not convinced, what about this? And then the third person is sort of a social democrat, kind of trying to bridge between the two swings of the pendulum, let's just say. So for this debate, Bob is going to be the defender of the faith. Fittingly, a lot of these ideas about these specific factors in consciousness are things he's been stewing on for a while, so it makes sense. Defender of the faith. Tucker's going to be the heretic, because he's a natural heretic. I think we mentioned that in last episode. And then, yeah, I kind of do feel like I'm a natural kind of, you know, hey, we can all get along, you guys. So this should be pretty fun. So, I think, but without diving into too much more detail myself, maybe Bob, I'll head it over to you if you want to just kick it off.
Yeah, let me do just a real quick overview. It essentially starts just with definitions. I think we get down the road talking about, like, going back to the Holberg debate about does consciousness reside inside the brain or outside of it or whatever. But it's kind of a fuzzy concept. It's a bit problematic to pin these things down. They're ephemeral, right? It's define love, define things like that. So consciousness, I'd like to start just as an overview, and then we'll hit these points and allow Tucker to rebut. So let me just classify in, say, four categories the difference between consciousness and subconsciousness, and then we'll go through them. So consciousness, the point of view, is subjective. The type of reasoning is deductive. The direction of reasoning is forward. And the type of memory associated with consciousness is semantic based. And the subconscious point of view is objective. The reasoning form is inductive. The direction of thought is backward. And the type of memory system is episodic. So there's a lot of stuff in there. I apologize just for the density. But I think that's where we have to start, is just the overlay of these four factors and comparing and contrasting the two forms of our, you know, mental duality.
I will definitely put this in. It is helpful to see it. So I'll definitely put it in the show notes for anybody listening. You can see these things. It is kind of like a opposites, right?
Correct. You know, it's a tension on each section of, it's like rungs of a ladder, and you're kind of balancing the two. And from previous discussions and conversations on the pod, there's evolutionary background to this. There's function. I don't think we have to go there. That's been covered. We can go there in the future. I'm just trying to set the tone for these exact, what does it mean when I talk about conscious is deductive and subconscious is inductive? It's very complicated stuff, but we have to kind of get into the meat of the thing at some point and not just hand wave over these words.
Yeah. Do you want to start with like the subjective objectives, like some examples maybe?
Please. Yeah. So let's start with most people think of the brain as some sort of form of computational device. I think it's a very beautiful metaphor. I think it's mostly accurate. But let me expand on it with a specific example that most people would know, which would be the difference between a CPU and a GPU. So CPU is going to be the analog to consciousness, and the GPU is analog to subconsciousness, in that the subjective experience of consciousness is linear. It's a thread that's unbroken. It's a single line. It's a path. So the CPU is running lines of commands over and over and over, one after the other, but in a linear fashion. And you can accelerate this process by having, you know, faster clock speeds or something like that. But essentially, it's always just one line after another line after another line forever. And that's a very good analog to your conscious experience, whereas your subconscious is going to be analog to the GPU, which is breaking a problem into parallel pathways, doing them all simultaneously, and then putting the end results all back together again. So that's obviously, there's different roles for each type, meaning GPU is for graphics. So if you're trying to calculate polygons, you don't have to do the upper leftmost polygon of an image and then do the next one over and the next one over and the next one over. You can do them all at the same time and then put them all into the field of view simultaneously. So it's a speed process. And this is also a callback to System 1 and System 2. I don't know if anybody's familiar with this. I can't recall. But System 1 thought and System 2, it's based on timing. So things that have to be done immediately are reserved, meaning like a bear's chasing you. Do you think plan A, I should do this, plan B, I should do this, and plan C? No. You start moving. You're running before you even know it. And you're built for that. You know, you're built for an adrenaline burst and, you know, instinctual actions. And then you're also built for pondering things, thinking things through, detail, you know, concepts that are not time restraint constrained. So System 1 would be analogous to the subconscious and System 2 to the conscious.
Interesting. Tucker, any thoughts?
You know, I don't have any argument against that yet. You know, your brain is, it's a parallel processor, right? You know, it's like, yes, the consciousness is driving, subconsciousness is what you're doing while you're driving, but you know, to me, it's almost like they're the two separate systems. One is the animal and one is the human. You know, your consciousness is the animal part of your brain. That's just you functioning, doing what you do to survive, while the subconscious is how you entertain yourself while you're doing what you do to survive. And, you know, when the bear's chasing you, that subconsciousness goes away. It's just gone. You're just an animal again. And I don't know. I've
got a question I think I'm going to pose now, but it, you know, maybe just for pondering, because maybe we don't want to get too deep into this, but, you know, what do you think the pitfalls and the benefits are of staying or being in one system more than the other? In other words, like if somebody, you know, kind of realizes, wow, for the last 20 years, I've kind of only been in System 2 and my System 1 brain hasn't really had time to practice or do anything, you know, and vice versa. Somebody that's like, I've spent 20 years in System 1 just, and I haven't really had time to have System 2. Like, I think there's maybe some interesting notions about that, but that might be like stew on it.
Let me answer real quick, just very quickly. I would think it would be a function of your environment. Meaning if you're in a place where you're being chased all the time, you don't get to get to system two. It's not a choice. It's not, but if you're in a place where nothing ever changes, there's no threats, you're just in a chair, you know, in a room somewhere for all time and nobody ever enters the room and you're just sitting there, there's no system one. You're just in system two. You're just daydreaming, you know, about whatever conscious thought you have. So I think that is correct, is that you could be locked into one or the other, but I don't think it's something that you choose. I think it's something that's evolved, that we have computational evolution. And it's a good time to bring up another illustration. So it's a thought experiment. I call it the whisper game. And this will maybe also answer that question. So the setup is, let's just say you're in a gymnasium and there's someone up high up on the bleachers, and then there's someone down on the floor, and they're going to play a game where the person down on the floor is going to give a set of instructions to a bunch of people that are walking around in the gymnasium, and the person up in the bleachers has to figure out what the instruction is. Mm. So the setup is all the people that are kind of clustered, let's just give them 100, say 100 people, and they're all blindfolded, but they're standing, what kind of, you know, milling around. And the guy on the floor whispers into the ear of the first person. And it goes in stages. So it's like sequential. So you'd have phase one, phase two, phase three, phase four. You have incremental progress. So it's not just that things are happening in a continuous way. It would be like you have the first iteration, second iteration, third iteration of these instructions being passed along. But the guy up in the bleachers is trying to figure out what is he whispering in their ear? What is the instruction? So,
but it's not like telephone game, like it's still the one person on the floor giving all the instructions, or are the instructions passing through other people? I may have missed that part.
No, great question. So the instruction is seated one time by the person on the floor. So he whispers in the first person's ear and then never does anything ever again.
Okay.
And so it is like telephone where it goes stage to stage, but I'm saying that it doesn't just happen without a sequential component. It's important. You'll understand. So the guy on the floor whispers into the first person's ear, and that's like the zero day before it starts. Then that person who was whispered, they whisper into somebody else's ear, the second round. Third round, they whisper into a different person's ear. And the guy who he whispered into the first time, he whispers into somebody else's ear. Third round, the first guy who starts sits down. The two people now, they each whisper into somebody else's ear. Fourth round, the guy who whispered, who is the second person in line, he sits down, and this whispering will spread out. I'm not going to go through it. It's kind of hard to visualize through verbalization, but the concept is, you're going to have a spreading of this message. And the person up in the bleachers is looking objectively down on everybody. So they're seeing the whole entire auditorium, the gymnasium. The people who are playing the game, they're experiencing it subjectively. They can't see everybody else. They either get a whisper or nobody talks to them that round or whatever. But when it happens, when somebody whispers in their ear, they will get the message. And the take home is, the instruction that's being whispered is, tell this instruction to two people, then sit down and never speak again. But you only talk to one person per round. I mean, that's so essentially what happens is, the first person gets whispered, okay, tell this to two people, and then sit down and never speak again. And so that next round, that he tells the first person, and the second round, he tells the next person, then he sits down. But as you plot that out, everybody who is in the whisper game, they will get the exact instructions, meaning they will know exactly what the truth of the game is. What is the instruction? They will each know it, but only when they individually hear it. Mm. The person up on the bleachers can detect this pattern. He sees this guy. He talks to one person first round, second person second round, then he sits down. And the same thing happens for every single person in the room. So the objective view will figure it out, same as the subjective view. By the end of the game, everybody's figured out the rule.
Yeah.
But it's at what point does the identity of the instruction become apparent? Well, if you're playing objectively, you could probably figure out that pattern pretty quickly.
Yeah.
If you're playing subjectively, you have to wait till somebody tells you specifically because you don't have the context of looking at everybody.
If you're that second person, then you know right away. But if you're the 100th person,
exactly.
Takes a while.
But the point is, subjectively, you're only going to get it when someone whispers in your ear. Whereas objectively, you can recognize this pattern by looking at all the milling about, all the actions simultaneously, all at once, and recognizing the pattern.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, I mean, because you're going to witness this exponential wave of people sitting down.
Exactly.
I mean, you're going to see that pattern pretty quickly.
But you can't really recognize the pattern, obviously, playing subjectively until it hits you. So that's exactly the point. By the way, little chef's kiss here. This is Fibonacci sequence.
I was going to ask if like the numbers eventually end up being Fibonacci.
It spreads as Fibonacci is what happens. And by the way, Fibonacci is the analog to this would be reproductive rates. So like if you look at rabbit reproductive rates, this is what happens is they go through these stages of growth that end up adding. So the two terms end up adding to make the third, and then it just progresses and grows in this format forever. It's just like Tucker said, it spreads as a wave. And let me do another example. I think we'll tie this in, which is a puzzle race. So imagine a jigsaw puzzle. And you're trying to figure out who's going to be the fastest one to put the puzzle together, the player who plays subjectively or the player who plays objectively. And by subjectively, I mean you are the piece. So each piece, you would be constrained by the piece itself, meaning you don't get to look at it from above. You can feel your way around. So you could feel, where do I connect to this other piece? Like if another piece comes on the board, assuming the game is one piece gets entered to play at a time. So you don't scatter them all about and play that way. You're racing where one person gives you a piece every 30 seconds and you're trying to fit it into the total. So the subjective player is literally like one piece at a time in the dark, trying to feel around, do I connect to this next piece or not? The objective player just gets the piece. And well, the real take home message is the subjective player is playing in a one time only format, meaning the solution is if you only play one time, like if you only get to play one time, subjective is the way to go, because you will find the solution by testing each and every one as you go, if it fits or not. And eventually, as you test each one, it will work. Eventually, you'll find I connect to this piece and this piece connects to that piece, etc. Objectively, looking from above, you don't play as any of the pieces. You're looking for the pattern. So as the board is completed the first time, imagine you are looking from above and you just write on the note, let's say it's a 10 by 10 grid. So there's 10 columns, 10 rows, 100 pieces to the puzzle. So if you know A1 is in the upper left-hand corner and A10 is in the upper right-hand corner, etc. Imagine then you have a Sharpie pen or whatever, and you write on the back of each piece when the puzzle's done the first time. So you just let the subjective guy win the first one. But as he wins, you write down the position of each piece.
Yeah.
Because you can see it from above. It's like looking at the box, looking at the picture on the box. So the subjective player doesn't get the picture. They don't get the pattern. They don't know that I put the eyes together because there's two eyes on an animal. You know, assuming like you're putting together a picture of a tiger or something like that. Like by looking from above, you can see this overarching pattern and you could put the pieces in place or write down the number of, you know, what location they should be in for next time. But you can't really figure it out in a novel way the very first time if you're just playing from above. If you're subjective, you could essentially play it in the dark because you're not looking at it from above. You're just feeling how it feels to attached to the piece next to me, because each piece is a jigsaw, right? It only fits with the piece it fits with. So subjectively, if you feel like you're the piece, you will lock into the adjacent pieces at some point, but you will never see the overarching pattern of the board itself. So if you were to play this game for speed, who wins? Well, if it's the very first time you ever play, the subjective side would win. If you play it many times, the objective side, by pattern recognition, would be able to mark where each piece goes and see that from looking at it from above.
Wow. It's like, those are really interesting, both those, because I don't think the actual point was to say one is better than the other, but it was in the context of a game and like winning both these things. I kind of felt like in the Whisper game, the objective one kind of was the winner, right? But in the Jigsaw one, you're kind of saying that first time the subjective one is the winner.
Well, anyway. You're not the winner in the Whisper game if the very first person is you playing. So if you're the very first person to get the instruction, you mentioned this, John, like you're the
right
first person,
yeah,
you would get it because there's no chance the objective guy would ever see the pattern when it was just whispered in one guy's ear.
Yeah.
So as you start, so it's going back to like this duality, there's a point to the system one and system two, which is they each have strengths and weaknesses, and it's an evolutionary pressure on which one you use at what time.
And that's how it all ties back to consciousness, is correct, that this is what's happening in our brain. Like this is your take. This is happening in our brains like all the time.
Correct.
Very interesting.
For point of view. So we're just talking about first person versus third person points of view. The difference between looking out through my eyes and looking down on me from above is everything. So the point of view of consciousness is yourself, your individual subjective self. The point of view of your subconscious has no face. It has no identity. It's doing everything like a GPU, all in parallel, all at once, just trying to cover all the bases. Because it doesn't
find the
have
patterns and stuff.
Yeah, because it's trying to learn the pattern. It's exactly right. Whereas subjectively, you can only experience what you experience. You don't get to envision the whole pattern because you have a vested interest in you because you are you. You are the conscious you.
Yeah. I wonder if this is a good time to ask and see, but maybe Tucker, you've got thoughts. But, you know, I have an autistic kid, so in my bubble, I've heard the terms neurotypical, neurodivergent a lot lately. I'm kind of curious, like, do either of you have thoughts about, you know, is this thing something that is universal for every human? Or do you think there's varying degrees and maybe someone who's more neurotypical experiences it more one way, a person who's neurodivergent experiences it differently? Is there still like a commonality no matter what?
100% on the money, that is what is happening. 100%. Such that.
Well, I also think that it's, I don't think anyone's locked into any one particular state. Okay, you take an artist, you run him through military boot camp and send him to a war zone. You're not going to get much art out of that person during that time. You are shutting down your subconscious as basically a survival mechanism and just using your training and your conscious effort to survive the day. Now you pull that person out of that war zone, you may start getting art from them again. But you're not going to have a person who's an effective fighter at that point because they're not just focusing on the war anymore. They're focusing on their subconscious and how they feel about it, and they're creating art that relates to how they feel, you know? I don't think any one of us is locked into... I think you can train your brain in and out of different situations. And I think that's largely true with autism. And that's something we're just kind of starting to dig into as a society of, hey, these people, the way their brain's wired, they don't view things the way the average person does. and it's affecting their ability to fit in, quote unquote, fit in to the norm.
Yeah.
And I think we'll have more tools as society moves forward and is a little more accepting of people who aren't the norm, how to get them closer to that baseline.
Or just, you know, I love everything you said there, particularly about, you know, a human probably is not locked into one thing, whether they're neurotypical or neurodivergent, because of this thing that's happening called time, you know, like we're constantly, you know, moving through time and, you know, change being like such a hand in hand thing with time that the environment, whatever you're doing, you know what I mean? It's this, I have to share this story. There was a through Progressive, somebody did this, came and did like a speaking engagement thing. Her name is Jessica Buchanan, I believe. She was abducted by Somali pirates doing like humanitarian aid kind of things in 2011 or something. I might have the date wrong, but she shared her story of being abducted for and, you know, kidnapped for like 90 days, about 90 days. And long story, really beautiful storyteller herself, just the way she kind of encapsulated her experience and shared it in a way is really, really powerful. The thing I wanted to share specifically was one of the things she took away in the moment is epiphany she had, like that kind of kept her surviving and whatever. She said, change is the author of our stories. And I felt like that was really well said, because it, I think it speaks to this thing that whether the individual is system one, system two, like spending more time in the consciousness, subconsciousness, neurotypical, neurodivergent, whatever it is, you know, the person on day one is just inevitably not going to be the same person day 10,000, you know.
Like, let me push things back with respect, because I think I don't disagree that there's a personalized journey and we change over our journey. But I do push back on the biology thing, and I'm just going to self-disclose. I think I got a touch of the TISM, you know, John, we talked about that before. But
yeah.
This is how I understand it, okay? And biology is a spectrum, of course. But the way I understand it is, it's the volume of signal being processed. So the ability to process multitudes of signal is a function of the GPU. So this is the thing that can break a giant amount of signal into discrete pieces and then run them all through pattern recognition and come out with something at the end. Whereas someone who is more biologically limited on their exposure to the signal from the outside world, much more easily can they go through one at a time, discreetly process things and not be overwhelmed. So there's an overwhelming feeling from someone who's on the spectrum, let's just say, based on signal strength or volume. It's just different. I don't agree that you can just have time to understand yourself or change. You're not going to change being a border collie. You're not going to change being a golden retriever. Like these, the way it feels to be a border collie versus a golden retriever is inherently different, and their behavior dictates this as such. Now, are there exceptions? Absolutely. And can you train one to be like the other? Yeah, probably. If you put a ton of effort in, you could probably get some approximation. But it's not the same, because the border collie feels the world a certain kind of way and a golden retriever feels it in a different kind of way. So my understanding is people who are neurotypical would have much less, say, pipe that is transmitting signal. So it's a more pleasant experience to go to an arcade or to be experiencing tons of sensations simultaneously, because you can just filter it out and just pick what you want to look at and pick what you want to think about. But someone who is autistic, it's like the big bandwidth, the cable pipe, like the most data possible. And the more data that comes in, the more you're processing it parallel. And it's just a whole different feeling, experience of how it feels to be a person. Now, from that, can you then adapt? Of course you can adapt, and you can change and learn and understand. So I'm not saying you're put in a, you're not in a box forever imprisoned by your birth genetics or whatever. It's not my point. But I'm telling you, you can't change how you feel about the world, because your body's processing the sensation of all the signal in the environment a certain kind of way. So for me, on a personal note, I don't do well in crowds. I don't do well in arcades. I don't do well with stimulation coming from each and every side, because I just become overwhelmed. But I'm also, you know, able to recognize patterns and absorb tons of information. And through my subconscious processing, I'm given, say, a result. And then I'm able to observe that consciously and take that result and discuss it or think about it. But that's my take on it anyway. I think it's a great, great line of inquiry, John, by the way. I think that's right where it should be at.
Yeah, I feel like I want to move us on to one of these other factors, but I feel like I want to say one more thing, because we could probably do a, you know, deep dive on some of this stuff. Part of what I am learning about, you know, autism is the old school. Well, first of all, this is very interesting. I've heard this from multiple sources. For many years, autism was only studied in males. And so there's this whole, it's almost like the replication crisis type of thing, where there's a whole body of research that's ignored an entire subset of our species, you know.
Just half of them.
Yeah, right. And it's so interesting that, like, I do think that's changing, and I do think there's a lot more research happening, which is great, because I don't think a lot is understood. One last closing thought for me that has helped my understanding is, again, the evolution of how to look at it and approach it. The old school was either binary. You're either autistic or you're not. And it's very interesting to me, because that still sounds like the idea between neurotypical and neurodivergent. So that's very interesting to me. But as far as autism, it used to be you were either autistic or not. Then the next kind of phase was, it was a linear spectrum. It was, how autistic are you? If you're autistic, you're either really autistic or you're not as autistic, or whatever, linear spectrum. The new school, I heard this from a therapist I talked to. I've seen it in diagrams and other autism research organizations and things, is it's much, it's depicted as like a spider web graph, you know what I mean? And it's more about needs, and each area of the graph is a specific need. And, you know, some people, like, so Bob, you know, your experience, overstimulation, like you have a need of not, you know, of needing like less stimulation in order to, you know, feel good and not be overwhelmed, and you know what I mean? Yeah. And that makes much more sense to me than the linear thing. It actually makes it, in some ways, it seems like, well, I think an argument could be made that that's how every human experiences their life, that they could look at this giant web. If we had this objective web that we could all agree on, and each, you know, with lots of various needs kind of scattered about it, I think that seems like such a common relatable that everybody could look at that and go, yeah, my needs are more in this area and this area, not so much this area. I think that's to me the whole point of it, is that it's rare that you would find two people, autistic or not, neurotypical or not, you know, who have the exact same web, who have, you know, or that needs biology, are the exact same.
Biology is a spectrum. 100%. It is a spectrum. And that's that. It's such a gradual change of these different cells in the web. I look at it like what you're saying is, like, each sliver of the web kind of covers its own topic, right? Each category is, and so we're an amalgam of all these different categories and different strengths and levels of each category, et cetera. And I think that's right where to look at it. But it's a function of processing. This is my point. It's a function of how people process the signal from the world.
Does this take us into, sorry to interrupt, but this kind of takes us into the reasoning factors, right? Was this where you were going to go?
Well, I'll just open it up, because I don't want to monopolize if this is debate format. Tucker, do you have point of view on the concept of essentially data flow for this.
To me, I think part of the bigger picture is that, you know, you take autism, you take neurodivergence. It's all about society trying to force everyone into their role. It's not about how do we get the most from this person? How do we find out what this person is going to be best at in society for them? It's about how do we get this person to be the least disruptive to what I want them to do.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
You know, if you look at it, one of the Kennedy sisters, who I think looking back was autistic, and the solution to that at the time was, we're going to cut out part of your brain.
That's right.
Until you just sit there and not cause a scene.
Yeah.
We're going to find out what is best for you, like what we can do for you as a person that stimulates you into being productive in a way that benefits society, but is also beneficial to you as a person. Our whole point of view as a species is we want you to sit down in your desk and do your homework.
Conformity.
Yeah.
You know, and you can take it for male birth control. It's out there. It's out there. Why don't we take it? Oh, because it's got side effects. And every woman on the planet goes, yeah, we know.
Yeah. Good point.
Yo, it's the scene in Oppenheimer where the girl comes in, you know, I think Oppenheimer himself says something like, can you type? And she's like, they didn't teach that in the chemistry course, you know, at Oxford or whatever. And there's a guy that's like, you know, we don't know what radiation does to the reproductive organs. And she's like, your reproductive organs are more exposed than mine are. You know, it's like, oh yeah. Whoa. That's kind of like, you know, again, I know Oppenheimer is a movie, not a documentary, but I feel like that sentiment has been there. I think what I was going to suggest, and then I would like to kind of, let's move into the reasoning factors here, but I'm probably simplifying it, but I feel like, again, that maybe the old school was society deciding it for people, and the new school is like the people should be just as involved in deciding what's good for them. You know what I mean? And I think that's what we're moving to, is like, okay, it's not so much like we know best. You should, you know, again, to go to the Kennedy example, we know best. We're just going to cut out some of your brain. It's like, I think we're moving as a society, I believe, maybe in my limited view of, you know, my bubble or whatever, but I do believe we're moving towards like, what does the person need?
Yeah.
It's like, why hasn't that been a equally important factor all along?
Counter that real quick and then I'll move, which is, it takes time to learn these things.
Sure. And
to look back with our current knowledge base is disingenuous, you know.
Sure.
Hindsight, yeah. 2020. Anyway,
yeah.
Really great topic. Sure. I love that. And we should do a pod on that. But let me move on to the next level. Combine the directionality with the type of reasoning, but we'll start with definition. So to recap, consciousness is forward deductive, subconscious is backward inductive. So deduction and induction, very important topic here. So induction, the definition is to take a general and go to a specific. And deduction is to take a specific and go to the general. So let's kind of figure this out. So if you have a bicycle, and there's a pattern of a bicycle, and you want to create a mountain bike, a road bike, a dirt bike, a kid's bike, variations on the theme. So the generality is bicycle. It's an idealistic pattern. But then you can induce specific variations of that generic pattern. So going from general to specific by customizing and adapting, you know, certain aspects of it, but it's still a bicycle. So you never lose the fact that it's generally a bicycle, but you can become specific through induction to create various, subconcepts. Whereas a deductive process would take a bicycle, and that's the specific, and it would try to generalize and say, well, it's got two wheels, and that's for rolling. It's got a handlebar, that's for steering. It's got a seat, that's for sitting. And it would break everything down from the general to the specific, specific to the general, meaning it's going to take the parts of the bike. It's not going to create another bike for you. It's not creative. It's deductive in that it's understanding what is the general principle behind this specific instance. So the bicycle itself is the specific, but you can kind of infer through deduction what its usage is without ever getting on it. If you understand that wheels are really good for rolling, you know, a padded seat is nice for sitting, the handlebars steer the front wheel, etc. So I'll leave it there. It's pretty minimalistic overview, but any thoughts on that?
No, sorry, that's Tucker.
Yes, because you can also take that pattern of a bicycle and just based on seeing that bicycle, you can go, okay, yeah, the handlebars, that's for steering, the seat's for sitting. But you could also take it a step further and go, well, that seat would be better if it had this, if I use gel instead of down filling, that would probably feel better. If, you know, I took that basic handlebar and wrapped it in grip tape, I would probably be able to hold on to it better. So I don't know. I think you can take a pattern that's already there and pull it apart and put it together in myriad ways based on what you know on other topics. I don't know. It doesn't always.
Let me put it. Inductive is generative. You are.
And that's the subconscious you're saying. Like the subconscious is the one thinking, what else is there, versus the conscious going, this is just what it is, observing it. Well, this is what it's for. Is that the
consciousness is understanding, whereas the subconscious is knowing. So knowing being a correlation and understanding being a causation. So they're different sides of different coins. So they're not in competition with one another. But when you want to create stuff, you need induction. You need to take a general principle and create specific examples. When you want to understand how something works in a causal relationship, you need deduction. You need to break down a specific thing and go to its generality to understand it. So they're not really in competition. There's a tension, but not competition, because we'll cover this in a minute. There's instances where each one is superior. It's not like one wins the day and the other one's the loser. It's during your experience. This goes back to, like, if you sit in a box with no input, you're just going to be daydreaming in your mind consciously all day long. Whereas if you're always chased by bears and your adrenaline's pumping and you're scared, like, think of a zebra. Like, a zebra is stuck in the subconsciousness. It doesn't get a chance to deductively plan ahead. And once again, we'll go to directionality here in a minute. But direction of thought is very powerful. So if I may, let me jump to an aspect of this, which is game theory. So game theory, another definition for game theory is backward induction. And there's a really good example of this, which is to take a maze. So like a placemat maze is the best example. If you ever went to Denny's or something, they gave you a kid's maze and crayons and stuff. Simple maze. So imagine there's like 20 entrances on the maze and five of them get to the finish line, let's just say. Well, if you're consciously trying to go one at a time, with your subjective point of view. You have to start at each one entrance and go through the maze until you hit a roadblock. And then you go to the next one. And now you go through that until you hit a roadblock. And you go around. You'll find each one of the five eventually if you keep going. But you're going forward from the start to the finish. The game theory concept is go backwards. So you start, it's cheating, of course, but you start at the finish line. And you're only going to find the five pathways out. Because from the finish line to the entrance point, you exclude all the dead ends. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I know I've done this before, but I'm kind of trying to remember, like, is it impossible that you would... that you would run into a dead end going from back from the end of the maze?
It's impossible. You will never find a dead end going from the finish line to your entrance point.
I feel like I need to test that. I'm skeptical. Well,
let's isolate it to one. Let's isolate it to one. I mean, instead of five options we'll hit. Let's just say 19 are dead ends. One entranceway gets to the finish line. Because I think that's more realistic. I did 5 and 15 or whatever. But realistically, let's just say it's one. So if you're working backwards from the finish in the placemat where you're looking down on it and you can see all the things, your finish line will have one pattern backwards into the start if there's only one path to the finish.
Yeah.
But the point is you start at the end and you go backwards in order to get rid of all the signals that are nonsense. So this is going back to GPU, CPU. You're trying to do all the things at once. You're willing to look at all the patterns. But by doing that, going backwards, you only isolate the ones that are successful to recognize the pattern.
Wow.
Whereas going forward, you have to test each one, one at a time, one at a time, one at a time. And you might, the very first one might be the one, honestly. You know, you have a 5% chance, 1 out of 20, whatever. You have one chance to get it right the first time if you pick the right maze entrance. But that's not how life goes. So when we try to recognize patterns, you essentially need to cheat by having the pattern repeat many times. Once it's repeated many times, you have the correlation. You know, after this, then is that. And by having that cheat of repetition, you can use backward induction. But it only works if you can repeat the process over and over again. And that's where the subconscious comes in, is this pattern recognition that doesn't need to have an understanding of how it works. There's no causal connection there. It just knows if I start from the finish and I go backwards, here's my entrance. Well, that tells me I should start there. I should now go in that entrance and I will get to the end. But it's looking from above. Obviously, it's looking down on the map or the maze, excuse me. Whereas consciously, you're supposed to be putting your mind in the paper. So you're going with the path. You don't get to look from above, right? So when you're subjectively going through a maze, you don't get to look at it from above. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It kind of makes me think of, I wish I could remember the exact wording, but the movie Inception, you guys have seen that, right?
Yes.
I don't think.
No kidding. Oh man, put that on your list for someday. It's fantastic. Well, any you know, I'm all seeing Christopher Nolan, Sir Christopher Nolan's praises all day long. I love that guy. But anyway, but there's a really beautiful, I think it's similar. Cobb is describing to Ariadne like the way dreams work, that like when we're dreaming, we're in between. I don't think he says conscious, subconscious, but he's talking about it in a way, and like getting in between there is where it's like pure creativity. And I think it's similar. I wish I could remember the exact phrasing, but I think it's kind of similar in there. But anyway, so yeah, I don't know, Tucker, any thoughts like to between that? Like, when was the last time you did a puzzle? I mean, sorry, not a puzzle, a maze.
It's been a while. It's been a while. But I can't really argue against the maze solution. I mean, a maze is a maze. The one thing I will say is it works better if you create a 3D maze, like a corn maze. But if you have the time, it doesn't matter which side you pick. I'm going to take the left hand because I'm a heretic. keep your hand on the left wall. You'll get out eventually. And it actually works on a paper maze too. I mean, if you're drawing a line and kind of hugging the left wall, you get to a dead end and you just come back to the beginning, and then it would take you to the next entrance, and eventually you're going to find your way out.
I think this is a better example because it's 3D, but let me inject into your hypothetical and say there's a guy in a hot air balloon overhead. That person can see the finish line. They can see the finish line, and they can look at all the processes that come out of the finish line. And if there's one entrance, there's only going to be one entrance of success. There's only going to be one part of the finish line that will connect to that. And so by looking from above, you can get rid of, I don't disagree with what you're saying. If you check every way, if you put your hand on the wall, et cetera, you'll find a way. My point is the advantage comes from starting at the finish and working backwards. But that comes at a cost. And let me jump to the next part of this, which is the antithesis of it, which would be a novel experience. And I like to use a snare example. So if you're walking, let's say you just I just created you. Let's say I'm God and I just created you. You're brand new. You don't know anything. You're like Jason Bourne. You just kind of, you can walk around, you can talk, but you don't remember anything. And you're in the woods and you're walking through the woods. And you see a snare, and by snare, I mean like a tree bent over, string tied to the tree, little loop, and then some kind of trigger mechanism. Now, even if you've never seen or you don't recall ever seeing a snare before, you've never seen this in your entire life. It's a novel thing. There's no pattern here. Like a deer, if it came over, you know, it might put its head in the noose because it's never seen a noose and it's not afraid. It might put its head in the noose, and there you go. The deer is dead. A human using consciousness would be able to deduce through the causal understanding that there's tension on the tree, and that tension's connected to the rope, and the loop will tighten once the tension's released, and the tension gets released by the trigger mechanism. So the adaptation of consciousness is to approach a novel situation, but it's not a bear chasing you for the first time. You still don't have time to think when a bear is chasing you for the first time. But if you're walking through the woods and you come across a novel situation, and there's something in the snare, right? Otherwise, you would just walk right by. There's something tasty in the snare. But you got to think, what comes next? And that's where your consciousness saves your bacon. That's why humans don't get snared.
And walk me through, like, because the way you described it, consciousness, deductive reasoning, seeing the snare.
You're going from a specific to a general. So the snare is the specific example, but you can generalize what will happen next because you can deduce that there's, like I said, tension on the thing. Like you understand, you have an understanding of what is happening. It has nothing to do with correlation. It's not this and then that. You have a novel situation that you can apply your general understanding and deduce the function of a thing that you've never seen work before. And that's the advantageous side of consciousness, is novel deduction and understanding of causation.
And it kind of, it's a fuzzy line between that and the subconscious, the backward directionality piece of it specifically.
Well, backwards difference is repetition. You need a loop so that you can see the end. Once you see the end, you can start again. But if you don't ever get a chance to start again, because the snare is your end, you only get one chance to figure that thing out. So you can't really use your correlation ability when it's a one and done situation.
I think I'm following. Yeah, it's like the large language model stuff. It's like that works because it has the previous iterations to curate from.
But it has no understanding. That's exactly right, John. It can predict the next token, or it can predict the next word in the string through a mathematical probability. But the computer has no understanding of what's happening. There's no causal understanding what the words mean. It's just giving you a statistical probability based off of repetition. That's exactly right. Correlate.
And that's again the advantage of the consciousness. Wow, that's really fascinating. Yeah, again, like I almost feel like Tucker. This is a thanks for being willing to be the heretic, because if I was in your position, my best argument sometimes would be like, no, I don't know what to say. Like, you know,
it is a hard one to be a heretic on, but I do have one angle that I can push here. So, let's say your ancestors out with a group of people in the woods. And your direct ancestor sees his buddy get snared and killed, right? And your ancestor goes on to have children that leads to you. Now you're walking through the woods and you see a snare and you have no concept of physics or mechanics that would, you're just not that type of person that goes, well, if I hit that tree's going to release tension, it's going to snag me. You may not have that ability to break that snare apart into components and figure out what it's going to do, but there might be an ancestral piece in your brain that still goes, danger. Leave that alone.
I think it's
more apparent in the animal world that animals are born with instinct. Well, where does that instinct come from? It's got to be some sort of something passed down from the previous generations. And so I think there's a little more to our conscious subconscious that's not us necessarily. It's neural pathways that were created in generations before that get passed on through DNA that allows us to go, I don't know what that is, but I'm going to stay away from it.
Yeah. And I heard you say, Bob, it's almost like Spidey sense. Yeah, that's really interesting to think about too. It brings up the whole like nature nurture thing. You know, totally. I would guess we're all probably on the same page that it doesn't make a lot of sense that it's that you would just that a person would say it's all nature or it's all nurture. You know, the environment, the situation, all of these things are factors, and you kind of, if you're going to answer, it's one or the other. What's pertaining to what experience? Oh, the snare thing. You know, well, here's, you know, some thoughts. It could be, like you said, Tucker, some instinct that was inherited, right? But does that apply to like the whole of the human experience? I think there's too much there to just be, you know, to settle on one side of that pendulum swing.
I think like everything in nature, it's a spectrum. You know, there's hundreds of hours of video of, you know, the person standing on a street corner and they're standing there for 5 minutes and they turn around and walk inside to a store. And the second they walk inside the store, something, you know, a sign or a light pole crashes and lands right where they just were. Did they have some sort of instinct?
Right.
Possibly.
Possibly.
But there's also hundreds of hours of Faces of Death videos where that person did not have that instinct and it did not end well for them.
Yeah. I did not watch this thing. Let me just say this real quick, Bob. Sure. I'm sorry, but because I didn't watch this, I heard about it just a couple weeks ago. I don't know, some giant saw blade that was like flying through the air, and the guy like just barely. Did you guys see this, or did you hear about it?
Yeah,
I didn't, like Kim described it, and I was like, no thanks, I don't need to see that. But it's the same thing. Anyway, so Bob,
I think this is the perfect illustration of. Okay, let me start here. The humans are animals. I think we all are on that page. And someone could push back on that, but I don't think we're going to push back on that.
No.
But our adaptation is to be adaptable, meaning we did not evolve to be as we are today. We did not evolve to go in submarines and spaceships. You know, we did not evolve. Like, I'm you know, kind of a ginger white guy. I didn't evolve to live on the equator. I'd be dead. I'm not kidding you. Yeah. Someone who's equatorial, if they evolve, if they had to find themselves where my ancestors grew up on top of a mountaintop or on Scotland or something, they might not have enough vitamin D and they would die.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a thing that we have, and I'm not disagreeing that there's instinct. I'm saying humans have it toned down to a different level such that we are adaptable to novel things. And that is our adaption, is lack of really hard-coded instinct. So I'll push back on that, but we are animals. And I do think that's how we evolved, meaning we came up from this pattern that you're talking about. We came up from everything was based on the feeling, you know, without understanding anything. So I think this is a layer on top of that. So consciousness was begot, or subconscious begets consciousness. So you have to start with what works as a biomachine. And we see all the other animals around us work at mostly the subconscious level, instinctual level. But we have this consciousness layer above. So my proposition is that we didn't start as consciousness where that is our go-to. We started like all the other animals, like the zebras, with the subconscious pattern recognition and feeling without any understanding. It's all corollary. But over time, our ancestors adapted and we added another level on top. So we didn't get away. We didn't do away with our subconsciousness, but we added a layer on top. And now there's a tension there where we release from the instinctual desire to do a thing without knowing why. It's still there. Like you may feel like you go walking down the street and somebody's walking at you. It just doesn't feel right. Like I feel in danger or something. And it's subconscious, perhaps, unconscious. But you get that feeling still. You can override it consciously, but it doesn't change the fact that you feel that way. And so that's where I'm at, is the evolution is layered, where both systems, system one was there first, obviously, by the numerical nature of it. It's there first, and it's underlying all of our decision-making. And then the system two is the conscious side that allows you to then not feel compelled to do a thing without knowing why. So it deviates from the instinctual side, but it's a great illustration of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, and I also think that the instinctual part is more prevalent in the animal world because they lack speech. That's all they have. They're very limited on how they can pass knowledge on to the future kin. You know, their offspring either has instinct or what they directly observe throughout their life. Where humans, because we have speech, we have this whole extra layer where I could literally keep a child in a room perfectly safe and still teach them about all the dangers in the world without them ever having to leave that room. And so, like anything, you know, I think the instinctual part probably atrophied. I think we tend to ignore it because we're vocal creatures. We're storytellers. We're our whole civilization is based upon vocal communication. And we don't rely on instinct because it's less reliable.
I really like that, by the way. And there's a very famous example. I might have mentioned it to you guys. I don't think we ever recorded it. It's an example of the lady who knows about red. So let's just call her Mary. Say she lives in a tower, apropos to Tucker's, you know, kid in a room. And I just tell this lady lives in a tower. The whole tower is black and white inside. Nothing but black and white inside. But she spends an entire career's worth of time learning about red, everything having to do with the color red, everything on a textbook, everything you could possibly read or know, all the history of red. But one day she walks out the door, sees a rose. Did she learn anything? She already knows literally everything, but did she learn anything by the first time she experienced the color red? And I would say, yes, she did.
Yeah.
But I think there is a bridge there. I love the illustration, though. I think that's exactly where we should go with it.
Yeah.
I would even say when she sees that rose, knowing everything she does about the color red, is she able to recognize that that rose is red?
She's not. She even that, know. That's what she learned. That's what she learns for the first time, is what it actually feels like. And one more thing, I'll touch back on what you said before about the ancestors and how they learn from each other. It really takes a specialized device that we have evolved, and a couple of other animals, I think elephants and the great apes, et cetera, which is this theory of mind or self-awareness, where you can see somebody else do something and put yourself in their place. Not all animals can do that. That's a really specialized human trait and higher intelligence trait. Now, there's also this thing called the blue dot test. You guys might have heard this, where you put a dot, like a sticky dot, on the face of an animal or something without them knowing it, and then you show them a mirror. Most animals would not be able to recognize that the thing in the mirror is their own reflection. So they won't touch their face to feel the dot. Mm. Whereas certain animals, I think even like mockingbirds or some kind of bird can even do this. A very limited number of animals that are aware that if they see a reflection of themselves and there's something on their own face or something on their body that they are not aware of because they can't see it, they will touch themselves in that place and they will they'll investigate it. That is very specialized. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah. Wow. Very cool. You guys have heard of Oscar Wilde?
Yes.
Yes.
Great quote here about that fits. I think you guys will like it. And then we should dive into the memory factor here. But he said, education is an admirable thing, but it is well to remember from time to time that nothing worth knowing can be taught.
Ah, nice. I like that.
The experience really is where the factor, you know, it's a force multiplier, if you will, you know, having the experience.
I like it.
So,
and by the way, one more time, when we hit this next part about memory, it goes right to what Tucker was saying about language. So I appreciate that segue. But memory, so let's recategorize and define. I'm saying that the subconscious memory is episodic and the conscious memory is semantic. So semantic is language based. It's based off of abstractions. When I say contextual memory, I mean how it feels in the moment. So I could give you a book that says, this is how you hammer in a nail. And you could read that. And it's abstract, but you could, you could understand it. Or I could give you a hammer and a bunch of nails and a piece of wood and say, do it. And so there's two ways to learn. One is contextual, one is semantic. So to that point, Tucker, I 100% agree. Humans have a different level, or two levels with which to learn on. And this is why it's so confusing, because neither is correct or the right one.
Yeah. Thank you for saying, I love that. You know, anyway, yeah, keep going.
So let's start with a concept of working memory. Working memory. So we all would agree, I think, that we have an inner monologue. I know some people don't, but would you guys just grant me that we all have an inner monologue?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So this monologue is abstract. Right, we're using language, which is an abstraction from the reality of the thing. It's like the map versus the territory. They're different, but there's a reason why they're different. You don't want to carry the territory around with you. That doesn't help you. Too big. You want an abstraction of the territory, which is the map. The map you can carry around. So language is your abstraction, and it's a huge tool that we're able to use. But we have not evolved to have a memory that is absolute through the abstraction itself, meaning when you have a working memory, I believe the average human working memory is between 5 and 7 items. Meaning if I give you a list of 5 to 7 random things, and I say, I'll come back in an hour and I'm going to test your memory. Most people can only remember 5 to 7 things. They just can't hold 20,000 things in their working memory. And so there's a reason for that. Okay. That the conscious memory is not for placing the data. It's for abstracting an explanation for the data. Now, let's flip it around. So how can we pull from the subconscious that does have episodic memory, so it remembers through the experience of the thing, just like an animal? If you ring a bell, right, Pavlovian response, if you ring a bell and then feed the animal over and over and over again, all you have to do is ring the bell and they salivate. So they have this, they don't know that the bell has nothing to do with the food, obviously. It's just this correlation. But it's built up over time, and we do this all the time. meaning as we grow up in our life, we do patterns like driving. Once you learn to drive, you kind of don't have to think about it anymore.
Right.
Once you walk, well, I don't have to think left foot, right foot.
Yeah.
I just walk. Okay. So these two forms of, but you can't just think about walking. You can't just like read a book about walking and then learn to walk. You kind of have to try.
Yeah, yeah.
Fall down and feel the pain. Scrape your knee. Understand how the balance works. All these things. So we have the tension between episodic memory of experiences and semantic memory of our abstract language. But here's the great example. So to test memory, people will do interesting things. So if you want to do a test of memory where you know you can only have a working memory of 5 to 7 factors, but someone wants to give you, let's just say, 35 factors, 45. Let's say I want you to memorize the order of a deck of cards. Okay, 52 factors, let's just say. Well, there's people who can do this, but the way they do it is they tap into an experience. So I'll give you an example of a famous gentleman who had an extraordinary memory. He was a horse bettor. He went to the racetracks for 30 years and bet on the ponies. And how do you bet on the ponies? Well, you understand which horse is faster before they get in the gate. How do you know which horse is faster? Well, they have times. They tell you the time that they ran on this track and whatever, under this condition, under that condition. So there's this guy who spent 30 years at the tracks, watching the races, learning each horse, how fast they were on each track, and making bets accordingly. Well, what he figured out he could do is if you give the order of the cards and he assigned the order to his, like a kind of horse, right? Each the ace of spades is this horse and the queen of diamonds is that horse or whatever. He could create a story in his mind that puts the horses in order and they run the race and he can experience what it feels like to be at the track. And keep track, no pun intended, all of these different horses in order. So you have like, say, 8 or 10 horses running, but each horse is representative of one of the cards or something like that, or their time is representative. So the point is, the gentleman tapped into his subconscious side, his pattern recognition side, his corollary side of this voluminous data set that he had incorporated into his subconscious. And then he could form a narration or a story consciously based off of that pattern. And it would stick. He could remember this for days and days and days. So it's not in the working memory. It's not in this memory component based on language itself. It's in his episodic memory. And that's where we hold the vast majority of our data.
I think was it Veritas who maybe had a really interesting video about like memory competitions the story. There was a couple stories. It wasn't the racetrack person, but it was the same thing. It was, you know, here's a whole bunch of numbers, just a random list of 1,000 numbers or some crazy thing. And that's the competition in these memory, memory Olympics or whatever.
Yeah. Memory Olympics. You know, that's exactly it. Yeah.
And they have to memorize it. And I remember this girl saying, you know, it's the pattern recognition. She would see, oh, well, the first four numbers, that's an address. I used to live in that house with that address, that house number. Easy. And then that's how she memorized all these numbers, was just building
creating
a story.
A neighborhood. Yeah, she created a neighborhood to walk through.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, really, really interesting stuff there.
Any pushback from the heretic?
Well, I think our friend Billy Collins would say that, you know, perhaps we're tapping into the consciousness of individual cells when we're walking without thought.
Interesting.
Those leg muscles, they've been taught how to walk without falling. And those cells being conscious of how they function in that situation can continue to do that. Because they've been taught that, which allows your brain while you're walking to perform other tasks.
Yeah.
Because it's not actually your conscious self doing it. It's the consciousness of each individual muscle cell that's performing their task.
I think each electron was conscious.
Yes.
And that meant right. each atom that, yeah. was conscious. That means each molecule is conscious. Yeah, that's.
But that takes it further to his point that there is only one consciousness. We're just different frequencies of that consciousness.
I'll take that as an alternate hypothesis. I mean, that is an interesting way to go with it. And
yeah,
it's hard to disprove, let's be honest. But it is an interesting explanation, because we still are stuck with, we cannot explain this thing of consciousness yet at the root, right? We can't explain how it comes about. We can't create it, except, you know, women create it all the time, obviously through childbirth. But yeah, I'll take that as a heretical stance.
So the next question is, like, do you think this is something that will be understood much more clearly, like, in our lifetimes? I know we, like, texted about this back and forth, but I'm curious, like, what you guys would say right now, like, specifically in our lifetimes. Do you see some definitive, conclusive evidence this is actually what's happening? Either cells have consciousness everywhere, or, you know, yeah, this is exactly how subconscious consciousness, you know, differs
in our lifetime. I personally do not think that the hard problem of consciousness will be explained, nor the disproving or doing away with panpsychism. I just don't think you can't discount it enough. You cannot get rid of it, because how do you falsify this? I don't know how it's falsifiable. So I don't think it'll ever be, you know, falsified, in my opinion.
Yeah. Tucker, what about you? I mean, you know, again, just specifically, like, in our lifetime, not
in our lifetime. No. I think in some ways language evolved as a way to describe consciousness. And
I like that.
It evolved as a way to allow our consciousness to leave our brain, in a way. You know, I can describe to you what I'm thinking.
You're exporting your consciousness to
another person. You're exporting your consciousness, but I can never describe a rose well enough to.
There's always more to learn.
Overrule, like, the experience of seeing a rose.
Yeah.
Like, I could never write a poem or a scientific description of a rose that's going to be better than just going, here, this is a rose. And you're like, oh, that's awesome. Well, I think it's the same with consciousness. I don't think we're ever going to be able to describe consciousness in a way, scientifically or poetically, well enough to go, oh yeah, that's consciousness.
Like, objectively, for all humans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I lean towards that too. You know, in my lifetime, yeah, I think I'm with you guys there. I like the idea that it's, I, you know, quote this line from Tenet all the time. It's not an excuse to do nothing. I think it's still worth the, you know, research and experiments, and let's try to, like, understand it more and more. But
well, this
but
I think going on since Shakespeare, like, a rose by any other name still smells sweet, right? I mean, that's the whole point. Is it doesn't matter what you describe it as until you actually can smell it. I mean, that is, you can't describe it. It's, I mean, you could, but there's an infinite way to describe it. There's not a singular way. Whereas when you hold a single rose and smell it, that's a singular experience.
Yeah.
And I think the pursuit is worthy, just because of when you study something in great depth, you may never reach the end point that you desired, but many things will pop up along the way that are beneficial in their own right. You know, each little piece you discover trying to get that big picture is beneficial. And so that's why, even though I'm of the belief that I don't know that we'll ever understand some of these big pictures, you still pursue that understanding, because the more you know, the more you can do with it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that also segues into this last component I wanted to talk about, which is the counterpoint to essentially the snare, which is this contextualized learning concept. Instead of it being novel, it's a repetition, but for what purpose? So contextualized learning, there's a really great experiment where they took people, and Tucker, you'll appreciate this as a scuba diver. They took scuba divers and they trained them to do a task. Can't remember what the task was, doesn't matter. It's just some arbitrary new task. And they had, I don't know, 6 weeks of training, you know, 60 feet down doing this task. And then at the end of the training, they timed them how well they could perform the task underwater. Then they took the same group of people, put them in a classroom, gave them the same task. Now you would think, because you're not underwater dealing with all the, you know, scuba requirements and all the distractions and stuff, they would do better. But in fact, they did worse.
That's interesting.
But here's where it gets really, really trippy. Then the experimenters told the participants to imagine you're underwater. Feel what it feels like in your imagination to be underwater. Perform the task again. Now it's back to the level that they were under their context of being underwater. So it goes back. Yeah, it's really trippy. It goes back, though, to this hack, this brain hack of using your childhood home address or whatever to build your narrative, meaning you don't have to consciously remember this thing. It's embedded in you. So the context of what it feels like to be underwater was a component of the learning process itself, different than the logic of the process itself, the description. So the contextualized learning is what alleviates you from the burden of having to figure this thing out every time, a la the snare. So it takes the novelty out of the system. And once the novelty's out, your subconscious will feed you the answers as long as you're aware that this is happening. Then you can take the answer and describe it abstractly with your language and use it.
So, and you'll have to forgive me because this was 20 years ago and I don't remember where this actually fell as far as lesson plans or what part of psychology we were studying when they did this experiment. But I had a Psych 101 class and I was the only male in that class, which was a little weird in its own right. But they had us do this experiment where, granted, I'm the only male, but they had a Barbie doll with clothes on. And it was, we're going to time you how fast it takes to take the clothes off the Barbie, and then we'll time you how fast it takes to get the clothes back on. And granted, I was the only male data point on this, but I smoked them all on getting the clothes off, right?
I smoked them all.
But they were much quicker than me putting the clothes back on.
Interesting.
And I remember saying this in class. I said, I have only experienced taking clothes off of a woman. I have never put them back on.
That's crazy.
Whereas wow, that is... you have done both.
Yeah.
And so you have that experience.
Yeah.
Well, you had the added motivation of you want to take the clothes off quickly, whereas they probably didn't care throughout their experience in their episodic period. Yes. That's a beautiful illustration, though.
Yeah, wow. And that is true about the quickly part, because it's, once again, my only experience in taking clothes off a woman is for a specific reason, and quickly was probably part of that equation.
Yeah.
Whereas they have all leisurely taken their clothes off at the end of the day in a nice, slow, controlled manner, and I have not had that experience.
Yeah. So what if, just for, you know, thought experiment, like, could you try to put yourself back in that situation, but it's a Ken doll instead of a Barbie doll? Do you think it'd be different?
I think the part of it is that there are aspects of women's clothing that we just don't have to deal with, namely the bra.
Well,
I
was thinking you're going with it where, you know, just not the human side of the analog, but the fact of like playing with dolls. I just thought you would be like a girl play with Barbies. That's kind of why I thought about it.
Which, again, you know, I mean, you know, you how many, like 20, 30 people in the class, would you say?
Yeah, probably 20.
I mean, you know, chances are not every single one of those.
That's fair.
Females grew up playing with dolls, right? I mean, it's not like it's a rule.
But that's kind of where I was going with it. I thought it was very interesting, the angle of,
yeah,
you have a motivation and practice of taking them off and doing it quickly.
Right.
So you have no incentive or experience putting clothes back on.
Back on.
No,
yeah.
No, in fact, I want that to take as long as possible.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Because I enjoy art. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
The beauty of the human form. We get it. We get it.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying the golden ratio in all its forms.
There, yeah, you, there go. You go. Well, we're doing good here on time. I think we're probably good for just like some closing remarks. I don't know, Bob, do you want to start?
I'll defer.
Defer?
Yeah.
Tucker, do you want
to? I'll say it's hard to be a heretic on a lot of this because there is a lot of speculation. I mean, a lot of the stuff that Bob brought up is very... it has been studied, and it's hard to be heretical against that because the body of proof is fairly overwhelming. I think it gets easier to be heretical when you're dealing more on the fringes than on the science of the brain as we know it.
Yeah. Well, I applaud you for taking the role. You know, again, this was our first stab at this. I think, Bob, I think you said in the text, like, this seems like a good format we could revisit, you know, many times over.
I think it's a great format, but the setup is wrong in that it's way too much detail and complexity that I have an overwhelming background on, and Tucker, unless he studied this, you know, it's not fair. Whereas I think in traditional debate format, you have a single proposition.
Yeah.
Very clear. And people get to see that ahead of time. And that's more of a fair and balanced way. I think this is an experiment, proof of concept, just trying to spice it up. But
again, we could have read all about doing this, but you know, it goes well from time to time, like Oscar Wilde says. Like, nothing worth knowing can be taught. We had to do this. We had to have this experience. We had to try it, you know.
Well, there's a Twain quote, Mark Twain. You can read all you want about a cat, but until you hold it by the tail, you know nothing.
Yeah.
So yeah. I mean, the reality is the reality. I think there is a moment of, you know, the experiment trumps all, you know, thoughts on the experiment. Once you do the experiment, it's like, that's the real thing.
Yeah.
So practicing this is the only way we would have ever figured out how it goes. I mean, we could suppose all we want, and we could have many theories on how this would have gone. But my take home after the fact is, single proposition, single topic, you know, clear lines, that's much more of a defensible debate. Whereas me jumping from point to point to point to point to point and Tucker having to react to those is not technically, you know, it's not technical debate.
Yeah, there's going to be topics that would be more apt to do that type of debate. I mean,
like,
perfect one would be UFOs and aliens. Bob and I know could draw that line pretty easily, and I know all the what ifs. I have studied that in depth enough. Like, I know all the reasons why people say there's something happening, whether I believe it or not. I could be the heretic on that all day. Yeah. On something like this, it's a little harder.
Yeah.
Plus a single line, like, I think it's literally like, do we invade this country? Yes or no? I mean, it's just like, just that clear, just that plain. And but they're so far apart, so you can have a wide distinction between the two. That's really important as well, I think.
Yeah. Food for thought. How
do you feel, John, about the thing? I'm interested in your opinion.
Yeah, I totally glad we did this on this specific topic. Bob, you and I have talked on these factors multiple times. Continues to blow me away. I think every time I hear something new, I have new images in my head. The way you describe it, thinking about it new in a new way. So it was really fun to do this particular approach versus just, let's just talk about it, but like within, with the intent. I call it a success. You know, I'm happy we did it. I can't wait to do it again. But yeah, I think it makes more sense to, like you said, if we go with this 3-person debate format again, maybe pick something that's a little more clear lined or whatever. Speaking of which, I don't know if we have ideas for the next episode. We don't have to decide right now, but you know, we're wrapping up here. So if anybody has a strike of inspiration at the moment for next week, anything coming to mind?
we could start talking about some of the concepts in 3-body problem.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't know if we want to, give that one the contact treatment as
right.
far as story, or just talk about some of the concepts.
Yeah.
Especially I don't think either one of us has read all 3 books, so we don't really know the full story, but I think there's enough in terms of tech and concepts just in that first season to kind of take that and run with it.
Yeah, I think for a couple episodes even.
Yeah, I'm on board. Don't do the book and the show. Just focus on the show, number one. So I think that would save us a ton of time. I'm trying to get through the first book, but I'm not through it. I'm not going to go through 3. There's no way at this point in time. But I did watch all the episodes. I agree with that. I like that. Fascinating, topical. It's kind of hot right now.
Yeah. So hot right now. Hansel, he's so hot right now. Anyway. Little Zoolander. Anyway, let's tweak that throughout the week, and we'll
hit for sure
one or two of those topics next time. And you know, whether it's a debate or not, we can figure that out. I'm not set on we should do the debate every episode from here on out, but I'm excited about doing it again whenever it seems appropriate. You know,
I think it would be more beneficial for if we're discussing things and a more clear line is drawn, that somebody's seeing it one way and the other person isn't naturally. Whereas this time it's like, I think we all kind of started pretty much of the same opinion, and trying to become an unnatural heretic. Like, I think it would be more, what's the word I'm looking for? Natural.
Well,
if the heretic is starting from a point where they believe what they're talking about, whereas I'm, instead of being, well, I'm going to push back on this just because,
just that's for the my sake role.
Yeah, I think the stuff like, so going back to contact, that was more about beauty and poetry and describing this magnificent work of art. I feel more like that should be the 3-body problem, is we're all, you know,
yeah,
looking at this thing from different facets and having our own point of view, but there is no unnatural opposition. We don't have to put that on us. I don't think that would make sense with a work of art like the 3-body problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree.
Right on. All right. Well, thank you for listening. If you're inclined, leave us a review wherever you're listening, but please do contact us, sendingpoets@gmail.com. If you're, have anything to share,
topic ideas, maybe.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I'm always looking for new rabbit holes to jump down.
Yeah, excellent. All right, well, thanks, you guys, and never forget, you'll never be alone with a poet in your pocket.